Chapter 1. February 19th of year 19.
They actually did it!
Marchenko too shakes his head, but immediately rejects this human gesture. That ungrateful pack, they threw him out of his own base, and he had been so full of hope when he finally saw Adam and Eve again.
My children!
He had recognized them immediately, even though he had not seen them for 14 years. They had grown into beautiful children. What am I thinking? They aren't children anymore. They're grown-ups. Marchenko, too, thought about it for a long time. Should he try to avenge this betrayal? Should he lie in wait for them when they leave the station? On the second day, he stopped outside the range of all sensors, sat on the ocean floor, and pondered his options and strategies. His hardware, Jay the robot, gives him freedom to endure. He can exist underwater for as long as he wants, because he has all the resources he needs. He is able to generate energy by using the temperature differences between various water levels. Using this energy, his fabricators can produce anything he needs to get along in this underwater world.
I have decided. I am going to accept their judgment.
He is already on the way to the dark hemisphere of this planet. A planet that always faces its same sunburnt and hot side toward Proxima Centauri, its sun. The decision has not been easy for him. It might be interpreted as acceptance of the injustice done to him. That was the only reason he hesitated so long, because he obviously did not accept the verdict of his children.
His children. When he thinks of them, he feels the infinite love he had to suppress for so many years. He is not responsible for what happened, not he, because he is the victim.
It wasn't easy sweeping away this argument, but finally, a probabilistic analysis opened his eyes. He calculates which courses of action were open to Adam and Eve. He knows a lot about Proxima B, things they have yet to find out.
They are stupid. They should have disassembled his body in order to extract his knowledge.
This would have saved them a lot of disappointment in the near future. But the knowledge he acquired over the years also tells him that Adam and Eve will inevitably venture into the dark hemisphere during their search for the former inhabitants of this planet. It is only a question of time, but he will see them again. If he gets going now, he will have a chance to thoroughly prepare for their arrival. The ground ahead of him is sloping down slightly. The pressure sensors report a cool current moving towards the north-northwest. He scans the ocean floor with his searchlight. That is an old, deeply human habit. He does not need light to discover obstacles, but now and then he feels the need to see, just like he used to in his former life. He decided a long time ago to put away such behavioral patterns. They do not belong to him anymore. They are part of what he once was, a human being with all his shortcomings. Today he is much more than that. He can be whatever he wants to be. For humans, that is a utopian idea and will always remain so. For him, it is a reality. During the first 4 years of his space voyage, he still believed he owed something to humans. But after the flare killed Adam and Eve, and the ship denied him a new startup for the Adam and Eve project, he realized he owed humans no debt. He is alone, but that doesn't matter. He can learn indefinitely, and his power is without limits. Still, he can clearly feel something is missing. The Creator has denied him the ability to create life, and it logically follows that his omnipotence is wasted if he has nobody to protect and to support with it. He needs Adam and Eve, and he knows they will come to him. Chapter 2, February 21st of year 19.
Shit, it's cold,
Adam yells. The water level in Valkyrie sinks as fast as the bilge pumps can manage.
Don't make such a fuss,
Eve replies, already starting to take off her thin pressure suit. I can easily understand, Adam. Taking a short trip in Valkyrie is much too cumbersome. The battle with the other Marchenko, Marchenko 2, for the station
set us back seriously in terms of technology. My robot body, Jay, still has not been completely repaired. We also haven't yet had the time to upgrade Valkyrie with a real airlock, or at least with a coupling port to attach itself directly to the station, meaning Adam and Eve have to swim through cold water. While the suit heating mechanism is working at its maximum, trying to keep them warm, water has a high thermal conductivity, and the cold ocean quickly reduces their body heat. The problem down here at the bottom of the sea is energy supply. The nanofabricators can produce almost anything from practically any material, but they need the energy to do so. On the surface of the planet, the local sun, Proxima Centauri, provides more than enough energy. But the underwater station laboriously generates it from currents and the temperature differences between various water layers. That limits our options. It is Eve's fault we are starting our first excursion today, only a week after the dramatic conflict. She complained until I finally gave in. The two of them were not convinced by my counter-argument that Marchenko too might have chosen to lurk nearby, and if so, I could not help them without Jay. Our destination is the alien transmitter, the only still working, possibly, trace left of the former inhabitants, as far as we know. It must have some function. Well, shall we go? Eve is really in a hurry. Is this caused by curiosity, or by boredom with life at the bottom of the sea? She and Adam spent many years on board Messenger, which is very similar to the station down here. It is clear Marchenko, too, deliberately placed his ship here and then expanded it. Another 37 seconds, I answer via the loudspeaker. The pumps are almost finished. And then? Adam asks. We will have to see, I say. Eve is in charge today. Adam sits down in the seat near the stern end of the cabin and buckles himself in. Eve sits down as well and turns the monitor towards herself. She checks where the transmitter is shown on the map, but she doesn't yet choose a course. Adam gives her a puzzled look, but she does not notice it. Then she reaches for the control levers to the right and left of the monitor. Valkyrie starts moving. For a few seconds, a metallic scraping can be heard until the vessel rises far enough above the sea floor. Eve does not seem to be taking the direct way. The small arrow on our screen indicates our direction of travel, and it points into areas we haven't yet explored. At this depth, there is eternal darkness anyways, which makes it hard for me to talk of a dark hemisphere. What would happen if we just keep going straight? Adam wants to know. We know too little about that, I reply. Yet the very question feels good. Columbus and his crewmates must likewise have agonized about that. Couldn't it just go on forever? The hair plants on the bottom seem to have adapted to the environment. We don't know, though, whether the ocean covers the entire dark hemisphere. Perhaps there are gigantic mountain ranges there. Think of the Antarctic on Earth. Adam glares at me. I don't give a shit about Earth. I just wanted to say that, on a certain planet in the solar system, the South Pole is not accessible by submarine, but the North Pole is. I did understand, Adam says, abruptly turning away. He doesn't realize that this gesture is futile, because there is always a camera I can use to look at his face. But I better not rub his nose in it. Stop arguing, Eve says. She calmly focuses on the screen that shows the radar scan of the environment. There are no discernible changes in the surface structure, as far as the instruments reach, but that doesn't mean anything. Shouldn't we start thinking about what to do next? Asks Adam, with his head lowered. He has gotten out of his seat and is slowly pacing. Yes, Adam, I'm setting course for the transmitter. Perhaps that will give us a clue. Eve uses the right lever to control the thrust of the jets. I notice a force seeming to act on us from the outside, but it is really just our own inertia. Adam places a hand on the steel wall of the inner hull. The vessel changes its course. While we approach our destination, Eve has the sensors checking in all wavelengths. The first measurement spike we detect is in the infrared range. The water temperature at the bottom is almost universally at 4 degrees. But on the monitor displaying infrared intensity, it looks as if, far away from us, somebody lit a candle in the dark. As I know more than the infrared sensor, namely the exact position of the object, I can calculate its emissions. This is definitely not a candle, but rather a small heating plant. I try to match this with the image of the transmitter I remember, but that doesn't work. What will Adam and Eve say about it? I'm very curious. While I have described the transmitter to them, my words seemed insufficient to me. Within half an hour, the candle flame grows into a bright glow, such as might come from a burning torch. The monitor displays an elongated oval, perhaps 2 meters high, that seems to hover above the ground. "Is it floating?" Eve asks. Adam points at the gap between the ground and the oval. "Zoom in on this area so it fills the entire screen." Without the blinding brightness of the oval, it becomes clear that there is a connection to the ground, but it radiates much less heat. I readjust the image to show the entire object. Something is bothering me. "There is something wrong here. Do you notice anything?" I'm not sure myself what I'm looking for. The whole scene does not feel dangerous, just strange. Eve zooms in again and focuses on the transition between the brightness of the oval and the darkness of the water it swims in. "Do you mean this?" she says. "Of course. The water is too dark. It should absorb much more heat from direct contact with the heat source. What we are seeing here would be normal in a vacuum, but on the ocean floor?" "The source seems to be very well shielded against its environment," Adam says. "But what's so unusual about that?"
"The fact that we can see it so brightly," Eve says, anticipating my own explanation. "The shielding seems to work only for thermal conduction, but not for infrared radiation, which we see as brightness here."
"And what's strange about that?"
"Thermal conduction works via direct contact," Eve says, really getting into it. "The particles transfer heat by colliding with each other. While radiation can be blocked quite well by using absorbent or reflective materials, that is more complicated with thermal conduction."
"You would have to prevent contact between the source and the outside."
"Yes, Adam, but regardless of which material you use for it, that material itself is made up of particles that collide and can conduct heat."
"Unless there's a layer containing nothing," Adam says.
"A vacuum, exactly. Without particles, there's no thermal conduction. Marchenko, can you calculate for us how thick this layer would have to be?"
"No," I reply. "I am missing too much data to do that. We have to get more precise measurements for the transmitter."
A tense silence reigns over the next few kilometers. On the radar display, the transmitter, or what we assume to be one, only appears during the last minute. It is hard to say whether it was deliberately designed this way, since the delicate construction might be responsible for the small radar signature. Valkyrie's searchlights shine on the dish-shaped object. Adam and Eve marvel at it on the monitor. The instruments indicate that the dish is 15.7 meters wide. It sits horizontally on the bottom, and no mountings can be seen. In the shine of the searchlights, the material appears thin and bright, like porcelain. A mast rises from the center of the dish. It has a thickness of about half a centimeter. We cannot measure this more precisely from inside the vessel, particularly as the mast doesn't seem to be evenly shaped. There are small bulges at regular intervals, the function of which is not identifiable. Most impressively, spheres circle the mast within the radius of the dish. They are concentrated on the side from which we approach the transmitter. At first glance, they seem to be made of the same material as the dish. These are precisely shaped spheres, each with a diameter of 98 centimeters, floating in the water at different heights and distances from the pylon. Adam points at one of the spheres.
"I wonder what their function is."
"I have no idea," I reply. "Maybe they are ornaments?" "On," I start, and then swallow the next word before starting over.
"Elsewhere, some structures are just built for aesthetic reasons."
"The dish alone shows that the inhabitants value beauty," Eve postulates.
"Or valued it," Adam adds, and Eve nods. "Sometimes the beauty of an object derives from its purpose," I say. "But you will have to get out to answer the question." I have to admit I envy the two of them right now. "If I only had a body," I wish to myself. While I can see the transmitter on all wavelengths, only Adam and Eve will be able to touch it.
"Done!"
Adam is already wearing his pressure suit.
Eve shuts down her terminal just to be on the safe side. While the hardware is supposed to be waterproof, caution can't hurt. We have to flood Valkyrie again to allow the two of them to exit. Hopefully, for the second to last time. Eve signals by giving a thumbs up after she has donned her suit. I let the water flow in, and Valkyrie sinks to the bottom. Then Adam opens the hatch. I imagine the blackness he sees above, and in the camera image, I watch him push off and swim outside. Eve follows him, and I accompany both of them with the searchlights. They are real naturals at this. I never managed to give them practical swimming lessons, but they move elegantly toward their destination. Near the dish, they let themselves sink to the bottom.
Wow, Eve says. From close up, it is even more impressive than on the screen.
Adam carefully touches the edge of the dish, which is about at chest height. I wonder whether I should stop him, but he probably would not listen to me anyways. Nothing can happen, I think, as the dish will hardly give him an electric shock. In slow motion, Adam first closes the fingers of his right hand around the edge, then those of his left. Nothing happens. All of a sudden, he jerks violently.
Hey!
Again, I yell.
Hey!
Not knowing what else to do in my panic. From here, I cannot help him. Eve pulls on Adam's shoulder, but I already hear his laughter via helmet radio.
You,
I shout.
That wasn't funny at all. Don't you dare do that again.
I'm beside myself and feel my heart beating wildly, even though I don't have one anymore.
And if I do, don't be so touchy, Adam replies.
Eve also reaches for the edge of the dish and pulls herself up. I realize what she is planning to do. A bit further inward, and perhaps a meter and a half above her, floats one of these strange spheres. She goes directly for it, arms outstretched. One hand touches the sphere first, then the other. Due to her momentum, the sphere is pushed slightly to the side. I record the exact position. What happens next is something I already suspected. The sphere slowly moves back to its original position, pulling Eve along. Considering that it looks perfectly round and seems to have no propulsion system, that is a phenomenal achievement. In addition, the sphere must account for Eve's weight while moving back.
Did you see that?
I ask. I'm not sure whether the movement could be seen well from below.
Yes, very distinctly. The sphere moved back after I pushed it out of position,
Eve replies.
One moment.
Adam says. He turns aside, obviously aiming for another sphere. He pushes off much more strongly than Eve did, also kicking his feet. He hits the sphere perfectly and drags it along. 1 meter, 2 meters, but he's already slowing. The sphere decelerates, brings both of them to a stop, and then they float back to the sphere's original position.
Not bad, Adam says. I wonder what else the sphere can do. Should we try to kidnap it using Valkyrie?
I don't know, Eve replies. This is alien technology we don't really understand. We'd better not stress it to its limits. Strictly speaking, we shouldn't have touched anything, I think. But how else are we supposed to find out anything?
The positions of the spheres must be very important to the aliens, Adam says. This means they're probably more than just decorations. You were here before, Marchenko. Has anything changed?
I did not record the exact positions, but I remember one particular feature concerning the placement of the spheres. If you measure their distances, you get a geometric progression. I check the numbers again. No, that is not correct.
Sorry, it's not a single progression. There are several. One might assume that the spheres are arranged in circles around the pylon.
There are 3 circles. The distances between the spheres of a particular circle form 1 progression. For the innermost circle, for example, this is 1, 1.5, 1.75, 1.875.
And what does this mean?
I don't know, Adam. It must have meant something to the builders of the transmitter. Now Eve moves from sphere to sphere. She measures each of the distances, again using the laser rangefinder from her tool belt.
Marchenko, she says, did you notice all these progressions converge on a natural number?
I calculate the limits of the 3 progressions. And indeed, they are all fixed values, rather than infinity. That is a strange coincidence.
Why didn't I notice this earlier?
Correct, I confirm. But does this mean something?
On the camera image, I see Eve shrug her shoulders.
It is probably due to the fact that mathematics is universal, I say. 1 + 1 is always 2, on any planet and in any language.
Too bad, Eve says. I was hoping we had discovered some kind of code.
Or at least identified its purpose,
Adam adds.
Concerning its purpose, we might have a chance to find that out. Please describe the material of the sphere, as well as that of the central mast.
1 second, I have an analyzer,
Adam says, as he reaches into his tool bag and pulls out a device that looks like a stubby pistol. The device bombards an object in as many wavelengths as possible, and uses the reflected radiation to find out what it is made of. Adam starts with the sphere he is holding onto. He pushes a few buttons, mumbles something incomprehensible, and then swims down to the transmitter dish. After repeating the procedure, he compares the data.
Ceramic, he says, so our first impression concerning porcelain wasn't far off.
What are its components? I ask.
Just a sec. I'm going to send you the data.
The analysis appears in my memory unit. Magnesium, calcium, titanium, cobalt, I read out loud.
What does that remind you of?
Could be some high-temperature superconductor, Adam says.
Perhaps, I reply. But unfortunately, we only get integrated values instead of an exact structural analysis. There might be several layers of different materials, or a thick layer in which all of these components occur. Those would lead to 2 completely different scenarios.
Couldn't we find out more inside the station? Eve asks. Messenger had a scanning tunneling microscope.
There is probably something like that in the station, Eve. But for that purpose, we would need to extract some material and take it with us.
Should I break something off?
Adam asks, acting as if he were about to hammer the analyzer against the edge of the dish.
Don't you dare,
I warn him, though I know he couldn't be that irrational.
The sensor is much too pretty to do that, Eve says. And what kind of impression would we make if we come here from far away and start smashing their china?
Never mind, Adam says.
He pushes himself off again and swims toward the central mast.
Oh yes, I think. We haven't examined it closely yet.
Adam stretches out his arms in front of him. I am watching him through the camera. He is just about to grab the mast when his hand is suddenly stopped. Adam tries it a second time, but once more, he can't get closer than arm's length.
What is going on?
He yells, and turns toward the Valkyrie, as if I could give him an explanation. Eve now also moves toward the mast. Does she think Adam is playing another trick on us? But she is also unable to touch the mast.
Remember the infrared images? I ask.
I've been thinking about that,
Eve says. The thermal conduction insulation is probably located inside this layer.
But what exactly does it contain? And why is it invisible?
Adam, why don't you try?
I don't even have to finish the sentence.
Adam takes the analyzer and aims it at the mast underneath the boundary layer. Silence reigns for several seconds. Time seems to stretch on. The device takes much longer than usual for its task. Adam stares intently at its display, though I know there won't be anything to see there except for the message, "Please wait."
The numbers are puzzling,
Adam says, after precisely 1 minute and 37 seconds.
How puzzling?
I'm sending them to you.
He pushes a button. Now I see the data. Adam has not exaggerated.
The numbers really are baffling, I say in agreement.
In what way? Don't leave me hanging here,
Eve says. The analyzer found nothing, I say.
Nothing? But there certainly is something there. You can see it, and it affects the thermal conduction, doesn't it?
Asks Eve. The device functions by examining reflected radiation at different wavelengths. But it didn't find any. Either the radiation is completely absorbed by the material around the mast, or it is passed through just as completely, I surmise.
The first case is highly improbable, Eve says. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to detect the heat signature of the transmitter so clearly from far away.
So the material must let anything coming from the inside pass through.
Correct, I say in agreement. It is much more likely that any radiation can pass through. We can test this with an experiment. Adam, set the analyzer to the maximum level, and repeat the analysis.
What good will that do?
He asks. If all radiation truly goes through the material, it would hit normal materials behind it and be partially reflected by them. This should appear as a background signal in the analysis. We need maximum performance for this. Otherwise, the signal would stay below the detection threshold. Normally, the analyzer is not supposed to measure the environment as well.
Okay.
Adam holds the analyzer gun as close to the mast as possible. We wait. This time, the procedure finishes faster. The device might have interpreted the background reflections as a measurement signal. Adam looks at what is happening on the display.
Your theory is correct, Marchenko, he says. Water, silicon dioxide, various salts, exactly what one would expect of an ocean.
He presses the send button again.
So we know the stuff in there does not shield from radiation. Not one bit. Therefore, it could only be a vacuum. Or something close to it, right?
Eve pushes off and swims upward along the mast, her arms outstretched so she can feel the invisible boundary. She reaches the top. The cover reaches all the way up here and is closed at the tip, she reports via radio.
I don't understand, Adam says. That doesn't make any sense. A transmitter that does not send but uses energy? That's totally inefficient. Why should somebody construct something like that, and even build it to last an eternity?
It can't be denied that the transmitter consumes energy, because it must somehow receive the heat it then radiates. Where does it come from? That is another question for which we do not yet have an answer.
Perhaps it is not a transmitter, but rather a receiver that needs energy while waiting for a signal?
Eve's idea cannot be easily dismissed. A switched-on radio uses electricity, even during times when no programming can be heard.
And the spheres? I ask.
Perhaps they serve to adjust the frequency, like tensioning or pressing guitar strings. Maybe Eve is onto something here. I am not quite convinced, but I feel we are getting closer to an answer.
You mean the spheres are like knobs on a radio receiver, adjusting it to a particular frequency?
Adam asks with a laugh.
That sounds so crazy it might actually turn out to be true. But who's supposed to turn them?
Maybe they are not meant to be changed. Then the receiver would be tuned to a fixed frequency, set to stay that way. That would explain why the spheres obediently return to their original positions, Eve says, as she slowly sinks down from the top of the mast.
I think we are wrong concerning the type of receiver. We are thinking too much in terms of Earth.
What do you mean, Marchenko?
I definitely don't think in terms of Earth, Adam says.
I wanted to say we are thinking in categories like radio communication. What if this has nothing to do with radio waves? Perhaps not even electromagnetic waves, but something altogether different.
You're considering something like sound waves? Not a bad idea, Eve says.
Sound waves are pressure waves within a medium. If I change the medium, meaning the water, by means of the spheres, that would be a kind of frequency modulation.
But sound waves don't make sense, because the range is much too short. The antenna is obviously aimed upward. Sound waves would stop at the vacuum and not get past the atmosphere.
The direction of the antenna, Marchenko, that is an important clue. It doesn't look like it can be changed. So during the orbit of Proxima B around its sun, it can reach only certain targets, Eve says.
Or be reached by certain targets, I think. I simulate the course of the planet around its central star. I know the position of the antenna, as it sits vertically to the round exterior of the planet. Which planets or stars could it possibly send a signal to or receive one from at least once a year? My program routines take a while to go through the entire star catalog. Finally, I get a result.
Alpha Centauri, I say.
The neighboring star? Adam asks.
Yes, what else? Eve says. It is obvious it had to be something nearby. Perhaps that is the star they escaped to?
I don't know. It could just be a coincidence, I say.
It certainly is, Adam says. Just take a look at the dimensions of the antenna. It has a diameter of just under 16 meters, and is even underwater. That would never be sufficient to reach Alpha Centauri with a clear signal that could be distinguished from background noise.
You're thinking of a transmitter again, Eve retorts. A receiver could be much smaller if the transmission power on the other side is large enough.
I still don't believe we are dealing with a rather undersized radio receiver here, I say.
Could we check your theory? Eve asks.
I think about this question. Whatever material the mast is made of, its outer skin exists in our world, and therefore must obey our laws of physics. Seismographs explore the interior structure of the world by sending vibrations, in their case sound waves, downward, and receiving the reflected signals. This should also work with the mast. We only have to strike it like a bell on top. Then the vibrations would propagate along its length and spread out. A large part would be absorbed, but some should return. Those signals will tell me everything about the mast.
Okay, then let's play the Hunchback of Proxima B, I say.
Adam and Eve stare toward the Valkyrie, obviously confused. I don't feel like explaining this to them. If it works, I can add the explanation later. After all, the two of them don't explain all their ideas to me. Valkyrie is not equipped with sonar, as a submarine would be. But a loudspeaker or microphone could fulfill the same function. The helmets of Adam and Eve contain sensitive microphones that can also receive sound from the outside. I would simply have to precisely log the vibrations caused by the measurement signal. I can get these data live thanks to the suit telemetry.
Could you two swim up to the tip of the mast and hit it with some object? I ask.
Adam follows my request, but asks in a puzzled voice,
Can I use anything? No matter what?
Yes, it's your choice.
Eve conspicuously shakes her head so that I can see it even through the helmet visor, but she doesn't say anything.
She swims upward with deliberate slowness and pulls a tool from her front suit pouch.
You can start whenever you are ready, I say.
The monitoring system of the suits will automatically record the two of them hitting the mast, along with the resulting sound waves. In the meantime, I am preparing some algorithms to automatically extract the data relevant for me. The measurement method might be primitive, but I am not aiming for high precision. I just want to know one thing. Does the mast end shortly below the ocean floor, or does it reach far down?
I take a look through the cameras. Both of them are having fun. Hammering something in a seemingly meaningless fashion seems really enjoyable. In a way, it looks odd, as they are not really hitting the mast, but instead are striking the invisible barrier around it. Also, the water slows their arm swing, so they are unable to hit with their full strength.
But watch out. You'd better stop if you get the feeling something is about to break.
Certainly, boss, Adam replies.
After 5 minutes, I have enough measurement data to get a meaningful result.
You can stop now, I say.
So what was this supposed to do? Asks Eve, who is slowly swimming toward Valkyrie.
Just a moment. I am running some calculations.
Don't keep us in suspense, she says.
Let's get back inside already, Adam says with a bored voice. I don't believe we can find out anything else here.
I hope to show them soon that the opposite is true. I nod my head until I remember that nobody can see this, because I currently have no head.
Yes, why don't you come back inside? As soon as I have the results, we are traveling back to the station.
The answer appears in my consciousness. It is an impressive feeling having the results of extensive calculations suddenly materialize inside my mind. When I was still a human being, I occasionally caught a glimpse of this, when a sudden inspiration made me slap my forehead with my hand.
How could I have overlooked this obvious fact until now, I would think.
I have a similar reaction to the result of the sound wave measurement. The insight appears out of the blue, right in the part of my consciousness that is actively dealing with this strange transmitter or receiver. Something, and I know that it is the algorithms running in my subconscious, drops it down. And then knowledge opens, as though previously hidden in a box, and it feels as though it should have always been here.
People, the mast reaches down several kilometers, I say.
Adam and Eve have already closed the hatch and are waiting for the water to drain. That's perhaps why they don't appreciate my insight the way I had hoped they would. Or perhaps I have to give them some background information.
This makes it clear what kind of receiver we've got here.
Oh, really? Eve says, sounding as if she is not truly interested in an explanation.
It is a gravitational wave receiver. It is meant for receiving gravitational waves, sure.
Adam interrupts me. I'd already thought something like that.
Is that so? I reply.
Yes, really. It was somehow logical, so far under the sea. The device won't be disturbed here.
But you didn't say a word.
Well, I didn't want to spoil your fun.
No matter. I shouldn't get upset now. If this is a gravitational wave receiver, this means there must be a transmitter somewhere. And that technology would not just be able to generate gravitational waves, but also to modulate them. This is far beyond mankind's current abilities. Learning how to do this would provide an enormous advance for us.
If this is a receiver, then where's the transmitter? Eve asks, as if reading my thoughts.
Alpha Centauri? Adam suggests.
No, Adam. The position of the antenna then makes no real sense for gravitational waves, I say. Those can be detected more efficiently if they arrive parallel to one of the arms.
To one of the arms, precisely.
Perhaps what we see here, Adam says, pointing at the screen he just switched on, is the arm of the sensor providing the control signal. The gravitational wave changes the lengths of the two arms, which are perpendicular to each other, differently. This allows the actual signal to be detected.
You don't have to explain the principle of a gravity wave detector to me, I say.
My voice sounds angrier than I intended.
You would have done it too in his place, Eve says.
I have to laugh. Eve is not completely wrong.
Well, you too, smart Alex, I say.
Then what about the spheres? What is their function? Do they serve just as decoration?
Each mass influences the spread of gravitational waves. Thus, they could function as a kind of tuner, Adam says.
They are much too light for that. Gravitational waves are created through the interaction between black holes or neutron stars, not by a few spheres with a diameter of 1 meter.
Of course, I know this is not exactly true, but only limited by our measurement precision.
The gravitational waves generated by a collision of the spheres would be minimal and impossible to measure, even for a technologically advanced civilization.
How do you know their weight? Adam asks.
That's not hard to estimate. The volume of the sphere multiplied by the density of the heaviest known material.
And what if the contents of the spheres are an unknown material?
That is pure speculation, Adam.
Everything we do here is a wild guess, so why shouldn't we engage in some reasoned speculation? What if the spheres contain dark matter? The lambda-cold dark matter model assumes that its particles would have to be very dense and heavy.
But we haven't measured anything.
Exactly, Adam says. Dark matter would not interact with electromagnetic radiation. That's why we can't see it.
I know all that, I say. But so far, all that is only a theory. Nobody knows what dark matter is made of. We are only pretty sure that it must exist.
My thoughts exactly, Adam replies.
So how would the builders of this device have collected dark matter?
A cubic centimeter of space contains, on average, dark matter equivalent to the mass of a proton. They just would need a very fine meshed sieve.
And how would they lock the dark matter inside the spheres? As it does not interact with normal matter, no wall would keep it in.
The spherical form is perfect for that purpose. Once you collect enough particles of dark matter, they would form a ball under the influence of their own gravity, Adam says.
A fascinating idea, Adam, I have to admit, I say in a congratulatory tone. But is it even remotely connected to reality? Wouldn't there be a danger of the super-heavy dark particles turning into a kind of dark black hole?
So what? Black holes are among the most stable objects in the universe. They will not evaporate until long after the last star has ceased to exist.
Nevertheless, nobody would like to have one of those in close vicinity, let alone 15 of them.
The black hole was your speculation, not mine. There might just be a lump of dark matter inside the spheres.
Could, would, might doesn't help us.
Pull yourselves together, guys, Eve says in a loud voice. This is ridiculous. Would you rather split hairs than solve our problems? Then let's just weigh the spheres.
That would hardly be possible, I reply. Remember how you pushed the sphere aside with your body? You could scarcely have done that if the sphere had an enormous mass. You simply would not have overcome its inertia so easily.
Or the sphere has a kind of motor that provides the required energy. Otherwise it couldn't float.
Correct, Adam. Perhaps the sphere does not contain any dark matter at all. That would be the simplest solution.
Yes, I know. Occam's razor. The simplest solution is preferable.
I just can't believe these sophisticated spheres are only a pretty decoration, Eve says.
Who would do something like that?
Humans might, I reply. But they could not send messages via gravitational waves. The very fact that we understand the functioning of this receiver is already a great success. And we have a lead. Alpha Centauri.
We can hardly reach that star, and I would not bet on her having truly understood this receiver, Adam says. I don't know what else we can achieve here. Let's go back.
We prepare Valkyrie for the return trip. This time, I take the helm. While Adam and Eve are dozing in their seats, I use all my sensors to observe the strange and simultaneously beautiful device left behind by the previous inhabitants of this planet. Will we ever be able to find them?
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.